thanks to the more than 1,000 listeners who donated to our end of fiscal year campaign. We still have limited quantities of thank you gifts in stock. If you've not yet donated, consider making a contribution of $8.50 a month. We'll say thanks by sending you a Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins mug. Learn more and donate at 704-549-9000 or online at WFAE.org. And thanks.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. The past week's news has been dominated by the Trump administration's policy regarding immigration and the separation of families crossing the border. But other political news of note happened as well, most notably in South Carolina, where the incumbent Republican governor is facing a runoff with a political newcomer to politics, with both the president and vice president coming to the Palmetto State to campaign for the incumbent governor. And the second Republican U.S. House member was defeated in his bid for re-election. Mark Sanford joins Charlotte's Robert Pittenger in losing his party's bid for another run, and Sanford put the blame squarely on President Trump. We'll get to our Palmetto politics segment later in the show, but we begin with the dominating news story that has caused an even bigger gulf between partisans and most of the country. With us to explain the context and the political dynamics of the immigration debate and controversy surrounding the separation of families policy is a panel of political experts and longtime friends of the show. From the nation's capital is Dr. Susan Roberts, a professor of political science from Davidson College. Dr. Roberts is an expert on American politics, where she focuses on campaigns and elections, the presidency, Congress, and women's politics. She joins us from NPR Studios in Washington. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning.
Joining us from Charleston, South Carolina, is Dr. Gibbs Knotts, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the College of Charleston. Dr. Knotts is also an expert in American politics, specializing in Southern politics, and having taught courses on the presidency and public administration, and is co-author of the book, The Resilience of Southern Identity, Why the South Still Matters in the Minds of Its People. Welcome back, Gibbs.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And in studio with us is Dr. Greg Weeks, professor of political science and public policy, and recently appointed associate dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Weeks is an expert on Latin American politics, having authored the books, quote, Understanding Latin American Politics and U.S. and Latin American Relations, and he blogs at Weeks Notice, all one word, blog.blogspot.com about these issues. Welcome back, Greg.
No, thank you.
What questions do you have about immigration to the United States, especially from Latin America? Where do you stand on the president's policies, particularly in terms of reducing illegal immigration and the separation of families? What do you see as the potential impact on the upcoming midterm elections? You can join our conversation by sending us an email to charlottetalks@wfae.org. You can find us on Facebook or even send us a tweet at Charlotte Talks. And there have been notable controversies about President Trump and his administration's policies in his short tenure as president so far, but this one seemed to take on a very harsh tone and a particular bitter divisiveness about it. Susan, I want to start with you, but I want to get all of your reactions to this past week and what you see playing out in this fight over immigration policy.
Well, one of the things that I think surprised even broadcasters is the traction that this issue has gotten to the separation of children from their families. I think two questions come to mind for me if I were to address, if I could say, what could you talk about? The first question is Trump on the ballot? And the second is the parlor game between, is this strategic or is it just ad hoc? And I think that the separation from the children is easy for people to understand. And I think that's going to really raise the stakes in what this has to do with the upcoming midterm elections.
Okay. Gibbs?
Yeah, you know, Trump is a history of not backing down, not changing his mind, never apologizing. And for him to, you know, say this was the policy and then issue the executive order, you know, it was a different Trump a little bit. I mean, I think he's regretted the executive order a little bit since then, but you know, that was something that may be a little bit different this time. I mean, as Susan said, it was, you know, definitely got a lot of people's attention, and there was a lot of support for doing something to try to bring the children back together with their families.
Greg,
well, for me, I think what was notable was that this was a definite shift with regard to how you deal with families. And so in the past week or 2 weeks, what we've seen is that the administration itself is deeply divided about whether it's a policy, whether it should be called a policy, whether it will be a policy moving forward, whether it's a policy that should be done by Congress or the executive branch. And for me, that was just seeing all the contradictions was notable.
Okay. Greg, I want to start with you and your expertise on Latin American politics and the relationship that the United States has with that region. According to the Pew Research Center report last year that analyzed census data, since the Great Recession of 2008, immigration to the southern border of the U.S. has shifted from Mexico to three Central American nations known as the Northern Triangle, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, with the number of immigrants from these three countries having risen about 25% from 2007 to 2015. What's going on in these countries that are bringing these individuals to the United States?
Well, I would really think of two specific factors. One factor is that both in Mexico, but then also in Central America, more hardline, iron fist, they're called, policies have been enacted, and the U.S. has pushed very hard to have these. So it's a militarized strategy to fight drug trafficking, basically. And that has ratcheted up violence tremendously. So homicides went up, all kinds of harassments, et cetera, went up. So that had, there was a lag time, and then people started to leave. They started to actually leave more as families. The other thing is that in 2009, there was a coup in Honduras, and that coup obliterated political institutions in the country, created political vacuums, and a lot of that was filled by, you know, criminal gangs. Mm. So that further pushed people. So the timing that we see in the Obama administration, I think, really relates to those things.
Okay. And you had written on your blog post over the past weekend, and I want to quote it here, "The number of myths and falsehoods is exponentially greater than at any time I can remember. I feel most frustrated when the national conversation is driven in large part by beliefs that immigration can be understood in episodic rather than structural terms." What do you mean by that?
So what I mean is that you will hear many people, including the president, but really people at all levels, is that, well, they see immigrants see DACA, so they're coming because of DACA. They see things as very time-bound, very, very recent, when in fact you have to look over many, many years to see how this built up over time. People in Central America are not responding on a weekly, daily basis to policy in the United States. They're responding to much bigger things. Oftentimes, they're not aware of what policy is in the United States. Okay. So there's push factors that are pushing them that are unrelated to what people think is going on in the U.S.
Okay. Susan, can you give us a sense as to, and Greg alluded to this, to the kind of inconsistency going on within the administration regarding the policy? Is it a policy? Is it a law? What do we know about what the Attorney General, the DHS Secretary has said about this particular issue?
Well, one thing, and it relates to what we've just said, is that as Trump said during the convention, I alone can fix it. And then it seemed to morph into I can fix it alone. And the backtrack with this executive order on separating children is one that people are saying this is a question that shows that they're more concerned about politics, not process and not policy. And I think when we look at these questions, we need to separate who the people are that are going to take this issue and carry it. And one of the things I think that we've talked about on the show many times, and that is the pink wave, that we have roughly 527 women running for elected office, the Senate and the House. And women are more closely associated with being empathetic, with being more family-oriented, with being more honest. And I think I think looking at not just the details, but how these are framed and presented to the voters on a state by state, district by district level. And I think we need to look at the optics versus the frames, because the optics up to this point have been very effective.
Gibbs, and well, I want to come back in a little bit later in the show about the political dimensions of this particular issue, but this isn't a recent issue for President Trump. When he announced for his presidential bid, this was a major part of his platform, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. He came down with the gold escalator in Trump Tower and talked about, said things about Mexicans coming to the United States. You could not go to a Trump rally, and we had a bunch of them here in South Carolina during the primary, without chance of build the wall, and Mexico is going to pay for it. And so he's been talking about immigration. This is one of the most fundamental issues that Trump has had, and it really unites a lot of Trump voters. But, you know, there's a lot of details involved, and, you know, there are a lot of personal stories. And you know, this whole notion of whether, you know, talking about the inconsistencies that Susan was talking about, you know, whether this is a deterrent, whether they think it's a deterrent, that just one issue itself was fascinating to watch play out over the last week. It's almost as if they didn't meet as a staff and didn't try to get all on the same page from what the HHS secretary was saying versus what the attorney general was saying versus what the president was saying.
Okay. According to a researcher at the Strauss Center for International Security and Law at the University of Texas at Austin, they wrote that since the Trump administration took office, the Border Patrol has detected fewer migrants crossing irregularly than during the Obama administration. And they give some numbers. In fiscal year 2017, these detections amounted to 0.075% of the total number of migrants. And they also mentioned the MS-13 gang. And out of that, 228 identified MS-13 members out of 303,000 total immigrants coming through. But the president has made it a point to highlight MS-13. Greg, can you give us a little bit of background as to what MS-13 is and what its role is in this controversy?
Sure. One thing that's really important to note about MS-13 is that it was created in the United States. So it was started in the U.S. It started because of a U.S.-funded civil war in El Salvador. So the U.S. put billions and billions of dollars in the 1980s to defeat Marxist guerrillas. And the government at that time was terrorizing its own population. People went in droves. So prior to that, we did not have a large migrant stream of Salvadorans at all. Now it's large because of, in large part because of that policy. Salvadoran migrants came to California and then felt like they needed to protect themselves. And then you had the creation of this gang. It's since become transnational. People are deported, go back, whatever, and so it's transnational. So that's a long-standing problem that the U.S. actually had a role in. It's high profile because it's extraordinarily violent. I mean, you shouldn't make any bones about it. Mm-hmm. It's a very violent gang. But it's not somehow a bigger problem now than it was in the past. And by and large, it's not a migrant problem per se. People might be deported. There might be undocumented immigrants here and there. But by and large, it's a gang that is fundamentally embedded in the United States at this point, so that it's very easy to make it a... It's very nice to say, well, this is this huge problem that's Salvadoran, when in fact that's really missing the point entirely, but people tend to eat it up.
Susan, you wanted to jump in on something?
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. I think we have gangs. I think it's a problem, but we also have to recognize, and this is part, as I think Greg could address better than I could, and that is how you're characterizing people that are crossing the border as undocumented, or saying they're refugees, and what are they fleeing? It's not just that they want to come to the United States; it's what they're fleeing. And I think the MS-13 fits in great for Trump in that one of his things was, crime, reduce crime, bad guy. These are people. We want people of merit. And I think that's pretty...
We'll pick up with that.
I don't like.
We'll pick up with that right after the break. This is Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're talking about immigration, the president's policies, and the politics of the past week with Drs. Greg Weeks of UNC Charlotte, Gibbs Knotts of the College of Charleston, and Susan Roberts of Davidson College, who I unfortunately had to interrupt to take the break. Susan, do you want to finish your thought?
Well, I think we've talked about it in terms of how you characterize MS-13, and we'll probably get into this when we talk about the politics, and that is what I would call disgusting. Mike Huckabee's tweet showing gang members, it would appear, as being part of Nancy Pelosi's reelection campaign. And so I think those visuals, and again, how they're being portrayed as, you know, they're right around the corner. They could murder you, you could get killed. And I think we all recognize gang violence, but I think how Trump is using it, and I think he's using it fairly effectively.
Okay, we've got a listener who emailed in. Josh sent an email. One of the things I never hear discussed in any of these conversations, why are these individuals choosing to risk it at all illegally rather than take the legal path? What are the hurdles, the obstacles, the cost that keep people from being a viable choice in terms of seeking legal immigration for these families?
I'll go ahead and jump into that. Is that there is, if you think of a line of, you know, get in line. Well, the line goes basically to the moon. It's enormously difficult. You have to have legal representation. You have to have a lot of money. And if you're talking about people who are fleeing violence that's happening immediately, and they don't have any money, it is simply not a viable means of migrating to the United States. You know, if you have money, okay, that's one thing. But if you don't, it's going to be so difficult that it's really not even it's not even worth starting.
And some of these immigrants coming in are seeking asylum within the United States. And generally, that has been defined as a humanitarian protection under international law. One legal expert on immigration said, most basically, people who seek asylum are afraid to return to their countries of origin, though the law requires that this fear meet certain standards for asylum to be granted. Is that what we're seeing, a great proportion of these migrants coming and seeking asylum because of the violence in their home countries in El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras?
Yeah, I think it has increased. I don't know the exact proportion, but they feel they have what's called a well-founded fear of persecution. And so they're saying that I am being targeted by gang members and from whatever country, or I'm being targeted by somebody. And so we're seeing more of those as the violence in those Central American countries, and indeed in Mexico, has increased.
Okay. If you've got other questions about the immigration issue that the country is facing right now, feel free to send us an email to charlottetalks@wfae.org. You can find us on Facebook or also send us a tweet at Charlotte Talks. Gibbs, I want to start this segment off with talking about the political dynamics and the ramifications. And particularly when it comes to the midterm elections, former Trump senior advisor Steve Bannon said, quote, "I think this is one of his best moments. This is why America elected him, the president. This is not doubling down. It is tripling down." And White House advisor Stephen Miller claimed that, quote, 90% of Americans support the separation policy. What do we know? It's only been a week pretty much of this controversy. But what do we know in terms of public opinion, the feelings of the public about this particular issue?
Yeah, I'm not sure what poll Stephen Miller is looking at, but most of the polls I've seen show the majority of Americans don't like the separation policy. And again, I mean, it's these suburban districts that Republicans need to hold on to maintain control of the House, where this is not going to play very well. I mean, we've got one here in South Carolina that I know we're going to talk about in a little bit with Mark Sanford, who just lost. But again, it's this growing area of Charleston with people coming in from all parts of the country. It should be a Republican district, but this type of policy that you know the Democrat is going to make an issue of, and there's a viable Democratic candidate this time to challenge Katie Arrington, who beat Mark Sanford. So it's going to be really, really difficult for Republicans to defend this policy, particularly in these suburban districts mostly outside the South in places in Pennsylvania and New York and California.
And Susan, there was a CBS YouGov poll that was released yesterday. In the poll, they asked, do you favor or oppose separating children from parents who are caught trying to enter the U.S. illegally? Those who said they favor strongly the policy, 11%. Those that oppose strongly, 53%. And in a separate Quinnipiac University poll, 66% of Americans oppose Trump's policy to separate migrant kids from their parents, but 55% of Republicans support the action. Is this just another example of the kind of tribalism that we're seeing in American politics nowadays?
I think it is an example of tribalism. And I think, you know, everyone can talk about the empathy factor, and no one really agrees with this. But Trump has gone on to say the Republicans need to let this immigration question go, and let's return to trying to elect Republicans and continue that red wave. I think how it's framed, as you point out, is very important, and how much this is going to play into the midterms, which, you know, weeks can be an eternity in politics. I think that what Trump has been able to do and what he can continue to do and what people have said the Democrats cannot do, and that is to frame this in terms of, very simply, build a wall, zero tolerance, and other questions about law and order. And I think those are going to resonate, and people are going to say, well, yes, but let's look at the other question. Besides just the fleeing violence, there are many people that would say, they'd put this as secondary, many Republicans, I think, and would say, quote unquote, these people, end quote, are coming here because of the so-called American dream. Trump even went so far as to characterize those crossing the border as the Democrats want these people to register to vote. And that was probably one of the most extreme things that I'd heard. And so I think that Trump can frame this in many ways. And I think it may take hold now that if we pass this, the question of what are you going to vote on, people will say, yes, but zero tolerance, build a wall, make America great again. Be very simplistic, because the Democrats, as George Lakoff and others have said, are not really good at framing what we've talked about in the past as family values.
Well, I want to talk about the framing component, and particularly how the president has approached this. Just yesterday, President Trump tweeted out that, quote, we cannot allow all of these people to invade our country. When someone comes in, we must immediately, with no judges or court cases, bring them back from where they came. Our system is a mockery to good immigration policy and law and order. Most children come without parents. He said in another tweet on June 19th, Democrats are the problem. They don't care about crime and want illegal immigrants, no matter how bad they may be, to pour into and infest our country like MS-13. Leaving aside the due process question that we can talk about later, I just want to talk about the language.
Yeah.
Greg, what does this say about in terms of using terms like infest, invade? What is that trying to get to in terms of what the president's rhetoric is about?
Well, you can compare that to in Latin America, there were dictatorships during the Cold War. What they commonly label their enemy as is cancers. Because, of course, if you have a cancer, what do? You kill it. If you have an invasion, what do? You fight it. So when you start using rhetoric like that, what you're saying is this is something that literally has to be fought, perhaps physically. And you label people as others. They are not like you. They are not good for us. They are criminals. And therefore, you're giving people license to target them and to potentially even hurt them. And so that's just sort of ratcheting up the rhetoric as a way to justify pretty extreme actions.
Gibbs, you talked earlier about what unites the Trump voter. Does this kind of rhetoric unite the Trump voter?
Well, I think so. I think it unites a lot of the Trump voter. I mean, that's the real question, is, you know, is it 40%? Is it 45%? You know, you see these polls, but again, I think people, you know, the first time they heard it was in 2016, and it certainly was enough to win the Electoral College. Now that, you know, now Trump has a record, he's been in for a couple of years, you know, what I'm looking for is, you know, if it's closer to 40%, and some of those people who said, hey, let's give this guy a chance, we need to shake things up, if they've seen enough, they're going to be really turned off by this rhetoric, these words like invasion and infestation. And so, you know, again, that's why we have elections. But, you know, I think very clearly Trump will be on the ballot. I can't believe there's going to be a Democrat who's challenging and running that's not going to run commercials with Trump and some of his rhetoric or tweets right next to whatever Republican candidate ends up running.
We've talked a great deal about the Republicans and the president. With the president deriding Democrats as wanting, quote, open borders, what are Democrats' options when it comes to this issue and how they're going to use it with the midterm? Susan, I'll start with you.
Well, I think there's a dilemma for the Democrats, and that is you cannot just blame Trump because his base is really, from what I've read, digging in, defending the president, and they may do that even in the face of tariffs. So they've got to figure out how to use the Trump base and what to do. They can hope that they can get a better turnout. What happened in 2016 is you had two different bases, you know, the more populist base and then the base of people. There were bankers and, you know, suburban, and they really started to buy the anti-Clinton factor. That anti-Clinton factor is not there. But I think that what we need to do is look at the race in terms of how Trump can move the agenda. I think Trump's going to be very effective. When we look at the politics, I just wanted to throw this in, is that the enthusiasm gap favors the Democrats right now. But how long, you know, will that evaporate? And turnout needs to be important for the Democrats and the Republicans. And do you vote against Trump or for Trump? I think it might be as simplistic as that.
Okay. Greg, we've seen the Republicans try to deal with this issue, particularly in the House last week. They were slated to vote on two bills. The more conservative bill written by Bob Goodlatte from Virginia was defeated, and a vote on what the leadership described as a compromise immigration bill was put off until today, possibly, maybe sometime this week. Is it in the Republicans' advantage to get this issue solidified in some way, or can they even work something within their own caucus to find a possible answer to this issue?
Yeah, so those are sort of two separate questions. Yep. My own opinion is, I do think that it would be to their benefit to actually pass something. I think that it's highly unlikely that they will.
Because what would it be? What would you envision as the best Republican option to try and address this issue?
You mean what would be in the legislation itself?
Yeah.
Well, I think the two main trade-offs, as I see it, is one that you have DACA, so you provide legal status for people who came to the United States as children. That's one thing that sort of unites most people. Then the flip side, the one thing too that Democrats don't want to include is to limit family reunification for legal residents and for citizens wanting to bring family from other countries. So, but you have to get the Republicans, there's many Republicans who don't want quote unquote amnesty. So those are the two things I think that are splitting the two parties the most. And it would benefit the Republicans to pass something, but it's gonna be extremely hard for them to do it.
Gibbs, how do you see this playing out in the US House with the potential compromise bill?
Yeah, I agree with Greg. I mean, the Freedom Caucus, you know, has been holding the Republican Party hostage in many ways. I mean, you know, Paul Ryan, you know, leaving as Speaker, I'm sure is extremely frustrated with, you know, just the inability to compromise. I mean, you know, our government was set up where, you know, people need to sometimes reach across the aisle. There are rules in place. Certainly that's the case in the Senate with the filibuster. And, you know, I agree. I just think it's very unlikely. It's such a polarizing issue. It's very unlikely. And then, you know, to not pass anything. And then I am sure the president will continue to blame Democrats. Although, you know, again, just to remind folks, the president is a Republican and the House and Senate are both controlled by Republicans as well. I think that's why the president's talked a little bit about the filibuster lately, because at least he can say, look, you know, we need to change that rule. We don't have 60 votes, and Democrats are being obstructionist.
Okay. One group that has been surprisingly steady in their support of the president has been evangelical voters. Although you saw some faith leaders like Franklin Graham objecting to the separation policy, but he did not fault the president. In a New York Times article over the weekend, Graham was quoted as saying, "This is not the administration's fault," and, quote, "I don't point the finger at Trump." Either Susan or Gibbs, let me start with Susan. Were you surprised that a leader of the white evangelical group, Franklin Graham from here in North Carolina, went against the president but didn't blame the president for this particular issue?
Well, I think he has been such a loyal supporter of Trump, even when we talked about LGBTQ rights, when we talked about the Muslim ban. And I think he's it's consistent with what he has said in the past. I think he would like to be effective in saying, yes, it happened. Yes, it's really disgusting. We're very sad about this. It's not Christian. But I'm not too surprised that he did this, because I think he's trying to really put forth Trump as someone who's empathetic, and he's looking at the bigger picture about America. And again, you have that curious defense of the president as someone who has been saved by these, the Access Hollywood tapes, accusations of affairs, and the Stormy Daniels. I think that they're still in that let's forgive the president. I do believe, and I think it wasn't as much as breaking with me, but he tried to make the Mark Sanford story about hiking the Appalachian Trail, and I think that Greg could address that better. But I think it's one of the, and Gibbs, I think it's one of the things that I wasn't surprised by Franklin Graham, and I don't think that many people were. I think it was just he spoke out on the issue to kind of give the president a little cover.
Gibbs, we got about 30 seconds before our next break, but what was your reaction when you heard about Franklin Graham and the evangelical approach to this issue?
Yeah, it was mixed. I mean, it's been such consistent support, and so, to say even anything that was anti the policy surprised me a little bit. But again, I think the ability to sort of parrot some of Trump's line and blame the Democrats and say, hey, we're just enforcing the law, we didn't make the law, was a way for him to speak out on an issue that he cared about, but also not criticize the president too badly.
Okay, that's Gibbs Knotts from College of Charleston. We'll pick up with our conversation about immigration and talk about Mark Sanford. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're talking about the politics of immigration and how it may influence the midterms with Gibbs Knotts from the College of Charleston, South Carolina, Greg Weeks from UNC Charlotte, and Susan Roberts from Davidson College. I want to shift gears since we made mention in the last segment about Mark Sanford and kind of shift our conversation to the Palmetto politics segment here and what kind of influence Trump may have on the upcoming election. In South Carolina, Henry McMaster, the sitting Republican governor, is in a runoff against John Warren, a businessman and political newcomer. With the runoff election scheduled for tomorrow, President Trump is scheduled to make a campaign stop for McMaster later today, I believe in Columbia, and the vice president was in the state this past weekend. Gibbs, you noted that it's, quote, strange to have a president come down, unquote, for a primary runoff election. Why is that?
Yeah, usually the party leaders, president, they'll get involved in the general election. They're going to, once it's Republican versus Democrat, they're going to go in and fight for their party. But to have a president, get weighing in a primary is a little bit, and again, it's all about personal loyalty. Back when Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, Lindsey Graham were not in the Trump camp, Henry McMaster was. He was one of the first elected officials to support Donald Trump during the crucial South Carolina primary, and Trump's a loyalty guy, and he's now going to show up, as you said, right in Columbia, going to make a campaign appearance at a local high school today. And again, great move for Henry McMaster. Trump, amongst primary voters, has a popularity probably between 80 and 90%. again, when the general election comes around, you know, this may come back to haunt McMaster a little bit if he is the nominee. But for the primary, he's got to win tomorrow. It's a good move for McMaster.
Okay. I want to continue our conversation on South Carolina politics, but this just coming in, several news sources are now reporting that the Supreme Court will not hear the partisan redistricting case from North Carolina and will return that particular dispute to the lower court. Susan, any reaction on the Supreme Court kicking the North Carolina partisan gerrymandering redistricting case back down to the lower courts?
Well, you know, I haven't had time really to digest that, but I think my reaction to it is that it's important because the court earlier in their decision, they said, you know, we're not going to decide on the state as a whole. We're going to do it district by district. And I think North Carolina was criticized more about the state overall, the districts, the state overall being really sliced and diced by the Republicans. And so I think it's probably a good thing for the North Carolina Democrats. But at this point, I'm not really sure. But I think one thing is certain is that the Republican idea to keep this as a referendum is very clever on their part.
Okay. Gibbs, I want to return back to you and talk about both Warren and McMaster have voiced their support for the Trump administration and particularly for this immigration policy. Our colleague Scott Huffman, who runs the Winthrop University poll, found that Trump holds an 80% approval rating among South Carolina Republicans, but statewide, only 46% of all South Carolinians approve of the president. Is this a potential danger for both Republicans to be so closely linked to the president, or are they going to use that to their advantage?
Well, they're definitely short term. It's smart. I mean, I think that, you know, it was a love fest. It's five-person primary that now Warren and McMaster are in the runoff. The candidates basically got in arguments about who was more Trump-like and who loved Trump more. Waiting in the wings, though, is James Smith, a military veteran, a member of the State House from Columbia, a Democrat, a moderate. You know, again, it's unlikely a Democrat can win in South Carolina. But look, as you guys know, there's a Democrat in North Carolina. There's a Democrat in Virginia. There's a Democrat in Louisiana. A Democrat can win in the South, and particularly if Trump, if the Mueller probe had some findings, if Trump's approval rating suffered, this could be, even in South Carolina, ruby red South Carolina, attachment to Trump could come back to haunt probably McMaster, possibly Warren, depending on who wins the runoff in the general election in November.
Any expectations, Gibbs, of what we'll see in terms of voter turnout for this runoff?
It's always hard. I mean, basically, you can vote if you did not vote at all in the primary, or if you voted in the Republican primary. It's supposed to be, I think, some bad weather moving in. So again, not super high turnout. I mean, the polls indicate that McMaster is likely to win. I expect McMaster to win. You know, he's a sitting governor. He almost won in a five-person race. Warren, you know, hasn't, you know, made a. I mean, look, Warren is so pro-Trump. McMaster has Trump and Pence here in the last couple of days. I just think it's a big battle for Warren. It's a big hill for Warren to climb in just a 2-week period. That's all we had was 2 weeks between the election and the runoff.
Okay.
How much money has been spent? I'm just curious.
Over $10 million. It's been, wow. I think, one of the most expensive, if not the most expensive, primary. And really the big spenders on the Republican side were McMaster. Warren spent a lot of his own money. He made money in the finance area. He started a company. And Catherine Templeton, who got third, got a lot of money, and she was kind of the favorite to be able to challenge McMaster. She wow. faded a little bit, and Warren really was able to beat her out for the runoff. But it's been a very expensive race, and I'm certain the general election will also be expensive.
Okay. I want to go back to our previous topic because we have a listener who emailed in a question, and I'll pose this to Greg. Renee writes in, Trump is seriously misrepresenting the status of most of these fleeing Central American countries. Most are seeking asylum. One can present himself for asylum at any official port of entry or at any other place. If they are seeking asylum, they need not present themselves at an official port of entry to enter the U.S. legally, and they have a year to make their case. We need to clear up the falsehoods that Trump is using to suggest asylum seekers are trying to enter the U.S. illegally, and we need to honor their rights under U.S. law. I guess this goes back to the Trump tweet about not wanting any judges, not wanting any court cases to hear these claims.
Right. And over time, there's been more and more of an effort, even under previous administrations, to criminalize border crossers. And so really what we're seeing under Trump is increasingly an effort to limit the number of people who can present themselves as refugees. And that's exactly why he did that tweet, because he doesn't want people to have due process, because due process takes time, et cetera.
And the Supreme Court has held that even those who come into the country are afforded Fifth Amendment due process rights under that claim. One of the examples, Ted Cruz is wanting to send more judges down there to hear these expedited cases to try and get the backlog taken care of. But the president has made it clear he doesn't want those judges coming in.
Right. And honestly, the backlog has been building for many years. It's in the hundreds of thousands. So if you're going to have more cases, it's impossible to do it without more judges. Unless you just completely get rid of due process,
right,
obviously.
Right. Okay. All right. Another turn of political events occurred in South Carolina's first primary election with the first-time defeat of U.S. Representative Mark Sanford. In an opinion column last Friday, Sanford wrote that, quote, I wasn't Trump enough in the age of Trump, and so I indeed lost. Gibbs, is this why we're seeing McMaster and Warren tie themselves so closely to Trump?
Absolutely. I mean, in the primary for South Carolina voters, you mentioned the Winthrop poll at over 80%. There really can't be any daylight between you and Trump. I mean, Sanford has been willing to speak out. He actually votes with Trump, 85-90% of the time. And historically, that's pretty strong support for a president of your own party. It's just that your typical Republican voter, a Republican member of Congress, votes with Trump about 95% of the time. And so there's just, he's been willing to go on the Sunday shows, say things against Trump when he disagrees with Trump. He initially was for Ted Cruz and spoke out some against Trump in the primary. And Trump doesn't forget, and it certainly hurt him in the primary. I mean, it wasn't the only thing. Mark Sanford had money left in his campaign account. I'm not sure he took this race as seriously as he should have. He's always been damaged with the scandal that happened when he was governor, and certainly has had people who have not liked him. But the Trump factor was huge in the South Carolina's first district 2 weeks ago.
And Katie,
and he said he was a dead man walking. He kind of realized
he
was coming.
He predicted his demise. Yeah. You're right.
And Katie Arrington, who defeated Sanford and was in a bad car accident, we continue to hope for her speedy recovery. Said basically that this is now the party of Trump, that the Republican Party is the party of Trump. And Sanford even addressed that. He said the Republican Party is going through an identity crisis. We need to decide who we are. And he also wrote, this suggests Trump's concern was over personal loyalty rather than issue loyalty. Sanford wrote, that's a problem in a system built on compliance to laws and the Constitution, not a single man. Let me give Gibbs a chance, and then Susan, I want you to chime in on this issue of what is the Republican Party becoming in this age of Trump?
I totally agree with the Sanford. It has having an identity crisis. I mean, Trump was a guy that no one was supporting. I mean, it was Jeff Sessions and Henry McMaster when he was initially running, and now people are scared to speak out. There's obviously going to be a leadership change in the House, and the Republicans are going to be looking for a new speaker. And I guess what I would say is, look, presidents, come and go. They're there for 4 years, maybe 8 years. Some members of Congress are there for a lot longer, and people hold on to their partisan identification for most of their life. And so I do think that the Republican Party is more than Trump, and it needs to probably figure out kind of what direction it wants to go and be able to, you know, have a life and figure out what it's going to be like after a Trump presidency.
Susan.
Well, I think that Jeff Flake talked about earlier that it wasn't enough to be a Republican in his book. It wasn't enough to be a Republican anymore. You had to be angry and vicious. And I apologize, I can't remember if it were Corker or Flake who said the Republican Party has become, quote unquote, this was the quote, a cult. And I think that when you look at the party, you have to say, how do you run as a Republican or as a Trump supporter? And I think in this next election, it's going to be as a Trump supporter. They showed on one of the stations, Charles Krauthammer, saying right after the election that the party is now the party of Trump. And, you know, that was 2 years ago. And I think most people are trying to say, you know, how much is the party of Trump and how much is Trump going to exploit some of the differences in the party? I don't think the intra-party conflicts with the Freedom Caucus and Paul Ryan are going to really change the direction. If you get down to it, to sound like a wonk, years ago, this political scientist David Mayhew said, members of Congress are single-minded seekers of re-election. And I think if you go with that, you're going to see the party be defined by Trump.
Okay. Greg, let me bring in two other quotes here. George Will, in his column this weekend, wrote to vote against the GOP this November and said, quote, Ryan and many other Republicans have become the president's poodles, not because James Madison's system has failed, but because today's abject careerists have failed to be worthy of it. And then there was John McCain's campaign manager, Steve Schmidt, who announced in a tweet this past week, quote, 29 years and 9 months ago, I registered to vote and become a member of the Republican Party, which was founded in 1854 to oppose slavery and stand for the dignity of human life. Today, I renounce my membership in the Republican Party. It is fully the party of Trump. What do you see in this state of the grand old party?
Well, yeah, I think that whatever big tent there was is shrinking. If you look at Gallup polls, you see that over time, fewer and fewer people self-identify as Republican. Many are self-identify as independent-leaning Republican, mm-hmm. but I think that it is becoming it's a smaller and very hardcore party. And if you're talking about Congress, then like we're talking about South Carolina, you're talking about primaries. And so you have to become more, or they at least feel they have to become more and more extreme, smaller and smaller tent in order to maintain, you know, their seat.
Okay. All right. In our final minutes here, I want to briefly return to the topic we started with, and I'll ask all three of you for your views. So, Susan, I'll start with you. What can be done by the administration, by Congress, to address the issue of immigration and particularly illegal immigration?
Well, I think that when Trump has asked that he wants Congress to do it, and then he acts and he realizes that I can do it by executive order, I think the onus is now back on Congress, and I think there are some people that are going to fight whatever comes out. And maybe that's just they're digging in because they want that as something that they can see and remind the voters that Trump is let's say mean-spirited, but I don't know exactly what kind of bill they can craft that will get anywhere because there are problems within the Republican Party about what bill should advance.
Okay. Gibbs?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as an American, as a person who cares about democracy, I think a package that includes border security, protections for the Dreamers, a more realistic time frame to come into the country. And so I think some compromise legislation is what we need as a country. But I'm like Susan, I'm very skeptical on whether there's the political will to bring a package together like that. And certainly, you know, I think people initially looked at Trump as somebody who would compromise and wasn't too wed to party. But again, he'll sort of lay out ground rules, invite everybody down to the White House, and then
let me give Greg the last word here.
Yeah.
Well, we haven't had any pass in a long time. We shouldn't probably expect it now.
That was Greg Weeks from the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, joining us along with Susan Roberts from Davidson College and Gibbs Knotts from the College of Charleston. Thank you all for the hour. This has been Charlotte Talks.